This is NPR Music. I'm Tom Heisinga. The music here is by Max Richter. He's a restless musician, composer, and an alchemist in sound, really, who doesn't seem to fit into any tidy genres. He studied at the Royal Academy of Music in the UK, but he's also worked with electronic music bands like Future Sound of London. He writes exquisite miniatures, but also full-length ballets, and even an 8-hour piece called Sleep. He's scored movies like Waltz with Bashir and A Sense of an Ending, and even rescored a classic by Vivaldi. And I'm thrilled that Max Richter is here with us today in our New York bureau. We're going to spin some records and talk about music. Max Richter, welcome.
Hi.
So, did I cover everything about you in that intro, or do we need to add some more? I mean, your tastes seem and your experience seem so broad to me.
Yeah, that pretty much covers it. I feel a bit exhausted even listening to that.
You've got a new record out, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. Mm-hmm. But is it fair to say that the album we started out listening to, 24 Postcards, was something of a breakthrough for you? I mean, I remember being bowled over by it, and I think that a lot of people maybe first discovered your music through that record.
Uh-huh. Well, I mean, that record was an experimental project, really. I think of all works, really, as a series of questions, you know, sort of what if? What if I do this? What if I try that? In a way, the compositional process is like a laboratory, and those postcards were, you know, trying to create vivid pictures with these tiny objects. And it was a fascinating kind of experiment.
Maybe you can, just for those who don't know about it, say what the idea was behind it. There are 24 short pieces on this record, right?
Yes, it's a collection of miniatures. And the thing that really started this process for me was the realization that, you know, people were downloading ringtones at that time. And I sort of felt like this was a missed opportunity for composers, that there was this sort of space opening up, you know, maybe a billion little loudspeakers walking around the planet. But nobody was really thinking of this as a place where music, creative music, could live. So I set out to make these tiny little fragments. And then, of course, from a sort of poetic sense, the idea of these little sound-carrying objects traversing the planet, I started to think about these as a sort of a connection, like a postcard, into somebody's life, into their space.
I think that the music on 24 Postcards gets at the heart of what a lot of people think about Max Richter's music, and that is that it's this blend of acoustic and electronic instruments and found sounds and treatments with these wistful melodies that kind of tug at the heartstrings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, melody is the sort of alpha and omega of composing, isn't it? I mean, melody is the thing that transports you through time, through the kind of the physical space that a piece occupies. So that's very central to me. And the language of the postcards is, yeah, it's very hybrid. I mean, you know, I have a sort of straightforward conservatoire education. So instrumental music, notes on paper are sort of my starting point. But that's not the whole story because, you know, we live in the 21st century and coming from also listening to electronic music and experimental rock music, the studio is also an instrument and a shaping tool and something which can be used creatively rather than just as a sort of documenting device. So for me, electronic music and instrumental music have always flowed together quite naturally.
There's a little section from your bio that I want to read just to get your reaction to. And it says, his unique and distinctive brand of heartbroken melodicism bridges the minimalist greats with pioneering electronics and the contemporary digital music multiverse.
Mm.
So what does that mean?
Well, that's very interesting. Very interesting, but it was sort of purple writing. I like the idea of a multiverse.
I do too.
I mean, I think we, you know, we do live in this virtual space in a way. You know, a lot of our media, ideas, texts, music, files are distributed in all sorts of spaces. And these spaces psychologically and virtually interact. So we live in this sort of cloud of possibilities. And I think that's very interesting. There's something very stimulating and engaging about that. And I think for artists of, you know, within music and actually pretty much any genre, that offers all sorts of ways to tell your story and to engage with people which were previously, you know, unknown, non-existent. And navigating a way through that space is part of what creative work now does. We are writing languages and we are writing forms as well as writing the content.
I want to ask you more about your music, but let's actually listen to some of the music you brought along with you today. And
sure.
What should we start with?
Why don't we start with Kurtag?
Okay, so this is George and his wife Marta Kurtag at the piano, right?
Right, exactly. So this is an arrangement he made of a piece of Bach from an early funeral cantata, Actus Tragicus, BWV 106. And for me, the idea of, you know, them sitting down playing through this beautiful Bach material is a kind of ideal, private, domestic kind of music making, which, you know, obviously used to be very commonplace when everyone played instruments. And there's something just incredibly, you know, emotionally engaging about this playing.
I can see how anybody would be drawn to that. I mean, that's that gorgeous
melody. It's sublime. It's just sublime, isn't it?
I don't know if it was Slonimsky or Baker, one of the folks that wrote Music Encyclopedia, said mm-hmm. that Bach was the supreme arbiter and lawgiver of music.
Yeah, I wouldn't argue with that. I always feel like when Bach is in a special case, really. They're, you know, if somebody says, well, what are your favorite composers? Really what they're saying is, what are your favorite composers apart from Bach? Because obviously Bach is your favorite composer if you're involved with music at all. It's a little bit like Mount Everest. You know, there's Mount Everest and then there's all the other mountains. And Bach is the sort of universal gravitation of music.
There's something so sturdy and soulful and kind of almost nutritious about music like this in a way.
Yeah.
That's a sonatina from Bach's Actus Tragicus. It's a cantata BWV 106 for you keeping score at home of such things. And the arrangement by the composer George Kurtag and his wife Marta at the keyboards there. Max Richter is my guest, and we're spinning some tunes. And you were born in Germany but grew up in the UK. I'm wondering what kind of music you heard in the house as a kid growing up.
Well, I heard basically rock and pop music of the time and the sort of core classics. So, you know, Bach, Mozart, Beethoven, and the Beatles and the Beach Boys. That was sort of it, really, which is, I would say, you know, kind of a solid music education.
And then I read somewhere you built synthesizers in your bedroom.
Well, yeah, I had a sort of light bulb moment hearing a Kraftwerk's record, Autobahn, when I was in my early teens. You know, I was fascinated by sound and music, and I was already composing in sort of simple ways. And I encountered this sound that I'd never heard before, and I couldn't imagine what instrument was making it, and this was the synthesizer at the beginning of Autobahn. And it was like being struck by lightning.
Fahren, fahren, fahren auf der Autobahn.
really sort of, you know, my life before hearing that and my life after hearing it. It was that profound for me. So then I, you know, attempted to try and, you know, obviously get my hands on this instrument that could do it. But unfortunately, you know, discovered that at the time they cost as much as a house. So this wasn't a possibility, but you could buy, you know, kits from magazines and then build these things with a soldering iron, you know, in your bedroom, which is what I did. So, yeah, that was really the beginning of my engagement with, you know, the studio with electronic music.
And you're a pianist by trade, right? I take it by that time you'd already been taking piano lessons and things like
yes,
that.
Yes, exactly, yes. Mm.
And you ended up studying at the Royal Academy.
Mm-hmm.
And was that composition you studied there?
Yes, I was half a composer, half a pianist at that time.
Yeah, all so. Right. Mm-hmm. And then we're going to bring you down memory lane a little bit. And you co-founded a new music ensemble called mm-hmm. Piano Circus and
right.
Made a number of albums. Let's hear just a little bit from one of them.
What a great piece.
Oh, yeah. So tell us what this is and what you're up to when you're making this.
Okay, so this is Steve Reich's wonderful six pianos. And, I mean, there's something so democratic and inspiring about this as a sort of model for music making. Yeah, you know, we were students. You know, I knew lots of friends of mine who played the piano, and we were casting around for something to do one summer, and we put this band together, really, just to play the Steve Reich and also Terry Riley in C in an art gallery. And we start playing and, you know, hundreds of people turn up. So we thought, well, this is a fun thing to do. So, you know, we took it from there and we played that piece a lot and we commissioned a bunch of other things. And yeah, it was great fun.
You know, now we're a good generation beyond those seminal American minimalists. How did being immersed in that music back at that time, how did it affect the music you were trying to put together yourself?
Well, I mean, I have actually, even previous to that, I have a rather odd encounter with a sort of classical American minimalism, which is really when I was about 13 or 14, I think. I was living in a, you know, suburban town north of London and, you know, dutifully practicing my Mozart sonatas and all of this. And the milkman who delivered the milk in the mornings was a kind of, you know, milkman by day, composer, artist by night. And he heard me practicing. So what he would do is he basically sort of took me under his wing and said, right, well, this is all very well, but you need to understand some new music. And he was an avid collector of the music that was coming out of New York at the time. So he would drop off the milk in the morning and, you know, the latest Philip Glass on vinyl. And
what a milkman.
Incredible, right? So, and, you know, this music was not available. You know, there was no internet. There was no way to find this stuff.
Well, and back then, actually, Philip was releasing his own records that you had to send away for.
Exactly, exactly. So this was, you know, I got music with changing parts, contrary motion, all these incredible pieces. And I was listening to them as a kid, you know. So that sort of planted a seed, I guess, really way back.
No. Well, let's listen to some more music. What's next in your pile?
So next is a track called What Part of Me from Low, the wonderful Low.
Okay, what part of this music that turns you on? Why this track?
Well, I mean, what's not to love, you know? I mean, it's everything about it is perfect, you know? It starts out with that little drum box, which has got a sort of a retro quality. Amazing fuzzy guitar and bass. It's got a perfection. It's really simple. It's full of yearning, and it's just perfect music.
What part of me don't you?
listen to a lot of what we kind of call indie rock?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a very creative space, you know. It's a space where there is a very open-eared audience and very, you know, it's full of curiosity and possibility. It's, you know, I like the fact that, you know, there's not too much kind of theory and rules around in that space. And,
right.
You know, there's some very creative music happening there.
Now, next I notice on your list is something really quite different from the couple of things that we've been listening to.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very big orchestral piece by Yannis Xenakis. Tell us about it.
Xenakis Jonchai from 1977 for 109 players. So it's a big band. And I became obsessed with Xenakis really pretty much the moment I heard. I think I probably would have heard Metastasis first from 1955. And I just think he's really what we'd call a visionary. His compositional approach had this quality of him making music as though there had never been music before that. He was sort of an inventor. I think of him in a way a little bit like Cage, you know, somebody who's inventing something out of nothing. And there's something very appealing about that. This piece is pretty much sort of golden age Xenakis, I would say, where all his technical and compositional conceptual work to do with mathematics and various structuring principles he takes from that, where all this stuff starts to come together with really direct emotionality. I mean, this piece has its roots in another work called Legend of Air, which is an electronic work. And the title of that work refers to the story at the end of Plato's Republic, where a character comes back from the dead. And Xenakis, of course, himself came back from the dead because he was a resistance fighter in Greece.
Right.
And was blown up. So I think of this piece as a sort of autobiographical work.
And it's loud.
It is loud,
this
isn't it?
This is about as loud as an orchestra gets, and it's
absolutely
thrilling. And
yeah.
If you haven't heard this piece or don't know, strap yourself in. Let's hear a little bit of it. All right, turn it up for the neighbors to hear.
That's so great, isn't it?
It's very good.
Yeah, it's one of those pieces where if you ever hear that in a concert, you slightly sort of fear for the orchestra or the concert hall or something. You just sort of feel like everything's going to blow up. It's one of very few pieces where you have that sort of feeling.
Have you ever seen it live?
Yeah, I have.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, it's incredible.
I would love to. That was actually what we heard was Arturo Tamayo and the Luxembourg Philharmonic.
Mm-hmm.
And the piece is Jonchai from Yannis Xenakis from the late 1970s. Yes, you mentioned before that he had kind of came back from the dead. What an amazing story. I mean, he was born in Romania to Greek parents. In his early 20s, he fights against the British forces when they come to Greece, and he's wounded by shrapnel in his face. He's blinded. He goes into hiding, he's condemned to death, but his sentence is commuted, he illegally crosses into France, and then he becomes like this total revolutionary of 20th century music. It's amazing.
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
Ever think of trying to write something like this yourself?
Well, I wrote a lot of music sort of like this, I say say that in inverted commas, but, you know, when I was a student, I was writing incredibly complex music in the sort of Fernyhough tradition.
Oh, really?
And I think that was pretty much the kind of orthodoxy at the time. You know, we really had to, you know, if you wanted to be a serious composer, you had to write very, very complicated music. That was just what you had to do. And I was sort of wrote a lot of work where, you know, it would have been easier to print it on black paper with white ink, would have saved on the ink. You know, it was just incredibly dense, very complex music. And then I actually went to study with Berio in Florence.
Right.
And he just kind of pulled it all apart because a very brilliant musical thinker. And he had this incredible instinct to sort of get at the heart of things. And he just sort of deflated all my complexity in this most sort of very charming but very laser-like way. And it was almost like sort of permission to be simpler.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, you know, just revelatory, really.
So you think he gave you permission to find your own voice more
I think
or less?
So. I think so, yeah.
As much as the music of Brian Fernyhough and maybe James Dillon, the new complexity composers, is interesting. I just wonder if we're all a little beyond that now.
Well, time has passed, hasn't it? It's interesting, you know, we maybe need to fast forward another 100 years, but, you know, the story of the 20th century in musical terms, classical music terms, is, you know, a story of real extremes and polarities and sort of reaction and counter-reaction. And, you know, when I was a student, you know, if you accidentally wrote a triad in a piece of yours, it was just sort of, it was like you'd broken the law, you know. I mean, you just couldn't do it. And that just meant you were a bad composer. And complexity was pretty much a sort of synonym for good or interesting. And really that tide does seem to have turned. And we've got now a musical culture which is much more hybrid and much more inclusive and much more open to influence and possibility from other spaces. And that's not to say what we might call sort of high church modernism is bad music. It isn't at all. Of course, there are some wonderful works within that tradition. It's just that for a long time, that was the only game in town and that was all we were allowed to do. But now we seem to have discovered a sort of more generous sort of aesthetic space, which I think is, you know, that's great.
And here's a good example of that space, I think, what you're talking about. It's a little bit of your own music. Let's hear it, and then we'll talk about it afterward. Music by my guest Max Richter from his latest record, which is music taken from the ballet that he has written recently. And tell us a little bit about the ballet and what we've just heard.
Okay, so the ballet is called Wolf Works, and it's a three-act ballet based on three novels of Virginia Woolf, Mrs. Dalloway, The Waves, and Orlando. And I made a record, a recorded version through that score, and that's called Three Worlds, because I do think of those three novels as three distinct worlds. And what we just heard is part of the Tuesday section, music which speaks to the novel The Waves. And this is a lengthy, sort of continuous piece, all based on sort of wave structures, but sort of occupying this idea of wave-like motion, so ascending and descending lines.
So you mentioned Luciano Berio was one of your teachers, and I see that there's you brought along a piece of his music too.
Yes, I've chosen Wasserklavier, which I think sums up Berio's musicality very well. What I found so striking about his work when I got to know it was the way in which he incorporated, you know, a very rigorous kind of modernist perspective with an engagement with music history. There was something very inclusive about his writing. You know, it didn't have that kind of scorched earth quality that you get in, say, you know, early Boulez, for example, where you feel like he's writing in a way to kind of obliterate the music of the past. I don't think Berio ever felt that. You know, I think there's a strong sense of musical continuity. And this little miniature piano piece, it sort of has bits of Brahms and Schubert sort of floating around in it. And I just love that about it.
Yeah, there is that kind of late Brahms, Opus 117 through 19 kind of going through, autumnal feel in a way.
Yeah, absolutely right.
And that's a beautiful job there by pianist Andreas Haefliger.
You know, that's real harmony going on there, as though harmony were a good thing.
Right.
Which is just an incredibly brave thing to do. If you think in 1965 what was going on, you know. I mean, that was absolutely, you know, against the rules.
But let's be fair, too. He did write a lot of what you might call challenging music and much farther out there than this.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is quite atypical.
So do you have one good Luciano Berio story?
I do. Okay. Well, I showed him this piece of mine, which was the most student composers at that time, or maybe even still, you know, they have their incredibly difficult piano piece. Based, you know, maybe on Xenakis' Herma or something like that. You know, this sort of unplayable piano piece, which is just really, really hard. And it's a kind of a macho thing, I think, you know. How hard can I make my very hard piano piece? So I had written my version of that piece, and I showed it to Berio, and he opened the score, and he basically just sort of laughed. He was just sort of laughing out loud, you know, and which was incredibly upsetting at the time. But I sort of get it, because the thing is, we'd all sort of written that piece. It was actually, I did sort of feel a weight lifting from me a little bit, you know, which was great.
What did you do with the score?
Well, I've still got it. I mean, if anyone has got, you know, a spare 3 or 4 years to learn it, then yes.
Okay, speaking of keyboards, I see next on your list is something, I just love your list because it's just all over the place. And this place specifically is Ethiopia.
Yeah, this is a record by Haile Mergia. I don't know if I'm saying that correctly. And he comes from sort of Ethiopian jazz tradition. I know very little about him, aside from the fact that he makes this beautiful polyrhythmic, full of interesting colors, this material which is very cleverly put together, beautiful melodic sense, and it's just a wonderful listen. Struck me about this material was when I heard it, it seemed to connect into all sorts of some of the early minimal things. I mean, it put me in mind of some of the multi-keyboard pieces of Terry Riley, for example, you know, things like Shriek Camel and that sort of thing. I just think it's just wonderful material.
I just love how these cool keyboard sounds and the very soulful accordion snaking through and around each other on this.
brilliant, isn't it? I mean, it's really sort of interesting polyphonic music. It's great.
It's Hailu Mergia and his classical instrument. That's the name of the record from sometime in the 80s. And the track is called Sunetwa. This is NPR Music. I'm Tom Heisinger. The guest is Max Richter, and he's brought a wide variety of things in today. And, well, let's see. The last one on your list is?
That's Mogwai from the Atomic soundtrack.
And how did you get turned on to this band?
Well, I lived in Scotland a long time, and I became aware of Mogwai really from the beginning, actually. And they seemed to me to be fusing art music, structure, and raw sonics. And I just think they're just very, very creative thinkers, musical thinkers. Their sort of nickname is the Scottish Guitar Army, which I think is also very good.
Something special about this particular track, which is Ether, right?
Ether, yeah. Well, I mean, I could have chosen, you know, lots of different ones, but I think this project basically sums up a lot of what they're about. It's quite sort of carefully wrought, but it still has, you know, tremendous kind of sonic power.
The build-up of the song kind of reminds me of things we might hear from Sigur Rós or even Radiohead or something.
Yes, it's a similar, I guess there's some kind of familial resemblance there. I think they're great structural thinkers, Mogwai. You know, the shapes are fantastic.
A little bit from the song Ether from the record Atomic from the Scottish band Mogwai. I was reading in some liner notes to a nice collection of four of your earlier records. The author of the notes talks about there are these smoky, mystical links he, meaning Max Richter, recognizes between Purcell and Aphex Twin, Bartok and Björk, Satie and Sigur Rós, Harold Budd and Burial. Those are quite cool names there, and I'm wondering, what is the link between Purcell and Aphex Twin? Purcell being England's great 17th century composer and Aphex Twin, this miraculous UK DJ composer and sound whiz.
Purcell to Aphex, that's an interesting leap. well, I mean, I adore Purcell. You know, he's my sort of, after Bach, he's pretty much my favorite composer, I would say. And what I love about Purcell is the fusion of wonderful technique with a kind of direct emotionality. Purcell can make you weep, but he'll make you weep in the cleverest way, you know. It's never just a kind of blunt appeal to the emotions. I mean, even the famous lament from Dido is actually a very smart ground bass writing. So that may be the kinship there. You know, Aphex's music is full of very clever stuff. And even, you know, very simple, maybe charming pieces, which he does sometimes, you know, they're full of ideas. And I think that's one of the things that music can offer us. You know, it's that sort of connection between ideas and feeling, sort of head and heart.
Right. So what's classical music offering us today? I mean, what's the state of classical music? There's always this perennial hand-wringing about its relevancy. Mm. And what excites you about it today?
Well, I think classical music in it's very multidimensional. I mean, that's one of the nice things about it. It's a field of possibilities, and it's a field of unique personal responses to, you know, the question of being alive. Composers, musicians, artists are people who respond to that question by making things. And it's a way to share our perspectives, our unique perspectives, on what it means to exist now. And for me, it, you know, that open space, that open creative space is incredibly exciting, and I want to hear what other people have got to say. So I guess that's what it offers. You know, possibly we do need to find new ways of talking about written down music. I'm open to all suggestions. I think classical music, you know, the term classical music is possibly a bit unhelpful, actually,
right?
Because I think it keeps people out who are not within that tradition.
Well, in that space, that open space you're talking about, you think there are now, you know, fewer genre boundaries now? Is the music more opened up?
Well, I think composers, obviously, we are products of our time, and, you know, people listen much more widely now, partly because of the evolution of, you know, streaming media and all of this.
Right.
You know, people just follow their enthusiasms through this music universe and encounter a lot of other musics. And I think composers are no exception to that. So, and then they bring that hybridic, polymorphous listening into their own writing. So I think, yeah, it feels like it's a more inclusive kind of a space now.
Max Richter, good luck with everything in the future, with your next projects. And I've really, you know, enjoyed your music over the years a lot.
Oh, thank you.
And I was going to spring a tune on you, but I guess we didn't have time. I was going to play a little bit of Brian Eno's Becalmed.
Oh, really?
From, do you know that track, from Another Green World?
Yeah.
That was a big piece in my early teenage years. When that
Brilliant.
Record came out in 75, I thought that was something new that I had never heard before.
Yeah, of course. I had that experience with discrete music. When I heard that, I was just, that's it. You know,
right.
I was just completely floored.
Well, again, good luck with everything. Thank you so much.
Thanks, a pleasure.